Good evening. This is Keep It Moving with Marcia Jews and Company on WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and the voice of the community. The Afro-American newspaper is turning 125 years old on August the 12th. We thought it fitting to share this very special audio documentary produced and created by Stacia Brown and associate producer Allie Post. Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, featuring the Afro-American newspaper, Jake Oliver, chairman and editor-in-chief of the Afro, Clarence Macy, circulation manager, Sharika Macy Oritz, assistant to the Afro Archives, Lisa Snowden McCrae, journalist and freelance writer for the Afro, and Sean Rios, senior editor. Kiera Kiles, journalism student at Morgan State University, and Kamal High. You've got to take a second and just enjoy this. And then when we come back after the break, we're going to have Jake Oliver, chairman and publisher, and we'll discuss why the Afro-American newspaper is still relevant and necessary in 2017. We'll be right back with Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, the Afro-American newspaper.
On an unassuming block of North Charles Street, in a building with a deceptively moderate glass front, live the offices of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. The Afro, as it's affectionately called, is the oldest family-owned black newspaper in the country. Founded in 1892, just 36 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Since then, it's served as one of Black America's foremost reporting sources, covering everything from Southern lynchings, the Scottsboro Boys trial, and World War II, to some of the earliest legal Black weddings and college graduations. It's no small thing to be invited past the cozy lobby and into the hallows beyond it. There's a scent of history inside. Old newsprint, aging paint. I was walking the halls that scores of bygone Black reporters rushed through, filing stories on segregation, war, or the election of Baltimore City's first Black mayor. After one day at the Afro, I knew for certain what some have only speculated. Time travel exists, and the Afro building is the time machine. For WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Stacia Brown, and this is Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, Episode 2, Eddie Afro. The first thing you need to know is that the Afro is old, really old. It's the result of an 1892 merger between three Black Sunday school newsletters that published community news, which, given the staunch segregation of the press, would not have otherwise been disseminated. John H. Murphy Sr. assumed ownership of the publication, renaming it the Afro-American Ledger. Remember that surname, Murphy. You'll hear it often over the next 25 minutes. You see, astoundingly, in 2016, the Murphy family still owns the Afro.
I think one thing, we have certainly helped to keep the white press a little more honest. Of course, we have brought news to Black people that they had never gotten had there not been a Black press.
That's the late John H. Murphy III, grandson of John H. Murphy Sr., in a 1971 interview for Columbia University's Black Journalists Oral History Project. He was responding to the question, what effect do you feel the Afro has had on the field of journalism? Mr. Murphy III started working for the family business after graduating from Temple in 1937. By 1967, he'd become president of the company.
One of the advantages of the Afro is that we had this family, and the sons came in and worked, and the next generation came in. I was the head of the business department, and my brother George was in the editorial department. My brother Jim was in the circulation department.
That was Howard Murphy, also a grandson of John H. Murphy Sr., in a 1972 interview with Columbia University's Black Journalists Oral History Project. Back then, he served as the Afro's comptroller.
My earliest memory would be running around the production department. spending a lot of time around the printing press, talking with all different types of people who were working there.
And this is Mr. Jake Oliver, great-great-grandson of John H. Murphy Sr. and current chairman and editor-in-chief of the Afro.
Back in those days, the process of creating the newspaper was an elaborate, employee-intensive process. Each page had to be created individually, and the people who were creating those pages had to develop the ability to read upside down and backwards, which was an amazement to me. It was a thrill for just about any kid to walk through the Afro in those days because it was a big operation.
We met with Mr. Oliver in person in the boardroom of the legendary newspaper's offices. There were portraits on the walls all around us, oil paintings of famed Baltimoreans like Thurgood Marshall, and a few of Mr. Oliver's ancestors, including Carl Murphy, John Sr.'s son, who ran the Afro from the time of his father's death in 1922 till his own death in 1967. Mr. Oliver's knowledge of the newspaper archives is encyclopedic. Throughout the hour we spent talking Afro history with him, he cited not only the years and headlines of several articles, but often their placement on the page.
Woodrow Wilson, we ran an article that talked about in 1912, when he ran for president, he realized that as a Democrat, he really didn't have too much of a chance in beating a Republican who were all powerful. And for the first time, the black vote meant something. So how did he go after it? He sent the bishop of the AME church into the black community to convince us that Woodrow Wilson will help the race progress. He's a good man. We endorsed him. 3 months later, after he got inaugurated, he fired every black person in the federal government who had any meaningful job and never hired anyone back.
More than once, Mr. Oliver told us, his searches through the newspaper's archives for national news like Wilson's election resulted in stumbling across coverage of his own family. For instance, Mr. Oliver found out that President Wilson eventually did need to hire someone black, an ambassador to some of the wealthier countries in Africa.
I noticed down the bottom of the page that it said that this fellow had been offered the job of ambassador to Liberia, and he rejected it and had a picture of him. I said, who is this dude? It's a black guy. So I looked at him and I said, looks familiar. And then I saw his name. It's my grandfather, John Burdett Oliver, who was a doctor in Indiana. There's so many surprises in history. You never can tell what you're going to come across, whose picture you're going to come across.
Aside from having grown up with a front row seat to the making of one of the country's oldest black newspapers, he's also spent much of his adult life sifting through the paper's archives. After our interview, we had an opportunity to do the same. The archives are housed right down the hall from where we conducted our interview. Bound editions of the Afro dating back to the turn of the 20th century are stacked floor to ceiling in the archives. Inspired by Mr. Oliver's recollections of memorable articles, I pored over a few dozen old editions of the paper myself. It quickly became clear that the Afro reported news that the white newspapers of the time probably wouldn't have touched.
A cloak of secrecy has been thrown around 22-year-old Clifton Sessoms after his daring rescue from a suicidal perch on the 12th-story ledge of a downtown hotel. The fair-skinned young man has worked for 3 years as an elevator operator at the hotel, which ordinarily employs only white persons for that job. Police said he had been under a mental strain because of this situation.
Perhaps because of its church roots, the Afro's articles, particularly before the Civil Rights Movement, often took on a rousing, preachy, editorial tone, with many editions urging readers to take direct action.
Pratt Library trustees announced recently that colored librarians will be hired at branches of the Enoch Pratt Library when vacancies occur. but that no colored would be admitted to the training class. Is the board really serious when it comes to this announcement? Outside of a few janitors and scrub women, none is colored. The Pratt Library has thrown us a bone. Will the NAACP be satisfied with it? We hope it won't be, but we'll perfect its case and file its suit.
The Afro functioned as a kind of confessional, its readers submitting letters confiding their frustration with segregation.
Two white soldiers passed me the other night, discussing the best way to entertain themselves for the evening. They considered bowling, swimming, skating, and finally deciding on a shooting gallery and novelty game house. It made me realize how little Baltimore has to offer colored soldiers in the form of recreation.
The Afro's war correspondents abandoned straight news reporting to admit to readers their shock at the atrocities they witnessed.
The closer we got to the place, the more peculiar the air smelled. It was like burning brown sugar with a low, sour stench of unwashed bodies. The woods adjoining the enclosure held more bodies of mangled, charred flesh. Everybody was so emaciated that arms and legs looked like water pipes or chair legs. They were of all ages, old men and teenage boys. Many bodies were naked.
It's worth noting that the Afro sent six of its own reporters overseas to cover various events of World War II. They did so at no small expense, but they had no choice.
I couldn't count them individually, but there must certainly have been 500 of them. Official reports say 200. I disagree. There were at least 10 piles of 50 corpses in each. A man of 60 with tears in his eyes and a boy of 15 who didn't have enough water in his body to cry if he tried came and kissed my hand.
Black newspapers didn't have access to newswires like the Associated Press. And though there were some colored newswires established to address that, the Afro wanted to provide its readers, many of whom had relatives fighting overseas, with firsthand accounts of what was happening on the ground.
I was the first correspondent in the terror camp. On my honor, it was one of the most inhumane attempts at racist termination any people ever suffered.
It's also worth noting that one of the correspondents the Afro sent to Europe was a woman, the very first black woman war correspondent in the country. Her first name, Elizabeth. Her maiden name, you guessed it, Murphy. I asked Mr. Oliver if there was one story the Afro reported during his lifetime that was particularly memorable to him.
In my life, the Emmett Till news story was probably the most impactful to me, and I think to everyone in my generation, because they posted a picture of his body on that front page. I think I was in the fourth grade. I just stood there and looked at it for, I think, hours. Because it took me a while to figure out that that's a person and what they did to his head and everything else. I'd never seen any disfigurement like that before. And then it started to sink in that that was caused by hate. And for the first time, I began to understand the importance of why Daddy was spending so much time at the Afro when I couldn't understand, why is it called Afro? And why is that necessary? And when I saw that picture, it brought everything home. I said, my God, there's so much hate out there that's personified by what they did to that boy. I think that changed an entire generation of kids.
After World War II and the gains of the Civil Rights Movement, big changes were on the horizon for the Afro. Up next, we'll talk about the next phase in the newspapers and the city's development. You've been listening to Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
I don't foresee it in the next 100 years beyond that, what's going to happen. Maybe 100 years from now, newspapers will be using all different types of distribution, which won't even be on newsprint, but that's 100 years from now.
That's John H. Murphy III again, rightly predicting a digital journalism revolution in his 1971 interview with Columbia University's Black Journalists Oral History Project. Little did he know, that would happen a lot sooner than he surmised. Computers would revolutionize desktop publishing only one decade later, and within 25 years, the internet would begin to drastically shift the way we acquire news. Mr. Oliver, current chairman and editor-in-chief of the Afro, was an early adopter of online news presentation.
Among the black press, we always prided ourselves as being the first. We were the first to have a website. We had our first website in 1994. And from that point on, we started to experiment with learning how to post, learning how to change and accommodate the way people were pulling stories off of the website and reading it.
Since 2003, the Afro has been working with Google to digitize its print editions of the paper.
We have maybe accomplished about 3/5 of the old newspapers have been converted to digital. And we put it up on our website, and it is a continuous source of amazement.
Even with its focus on keeping up with the times, some of the Afro's most loyal readers are its oldest, Luddites, who as subscribers still receive print editions of the paper when it's published every Thursday, or who go to their local supermarkets to pick it up fresh from the newsstand. The Afro has always been innovative, but in many ways it represents the nostalgia of bygone times in Black Baltimore, too. Consider Mr. Clarence Massey, circulation manager of the Afro. As an adult, he's worked for the Afro for 14 years, but his connection to the paper dates back much further.
As a kid, I used to sell papers on the buses in the neighborhoods. Back in the 70s, late 60s, we used to jump on the bus, and we used to get on the bus for free, and until we ran out of papers, then we had to get off. But we used to get all over the city with that.
For decades, at the height of its circulation, when the Afro had editions in as many as 12 markets other than Baltimore, including D.C., Richmond, and Philadelphia, paper boys and paper girls were essential members of the news team and valued members of the communities where they delivered. They'd call out a familiar refrain as they approached, just as they were about to toss papers into yards and onto stoops. We asked Mr. Massey to say it for us.
I'd rather not say it. Eddie Afro!
Fun fact, the Afro boasts one of the most impressive rosters of former paperboys imaginable. Former Congressman Kwaisi Nfume, current Congressman Elijah Cummings, and attorney Billy Murphy, a longtime Baltimore luminary who you may know as the late Freddie Gray's family lawyer. Mr. Massey credits his job as a paperboy with teaching him a sense of responsibility and maturity.
When I got up in the morning, I went out and served Afros, and then I went to school. And I always used that change for my lunch money and stuff like that. And my parents did all the, you know, the buying of my clothes, but after I started selling papers, it was over.
Sadly, the heyday of the Baltimore City paperboy drew to a close not long after Mr. Massey's tenure. In 1971, Afro comptroller Howard Murphy spoke to the reasons for the change.
Newsboys are hard, well, not only the Afro, but a lot of daily papers have difficulty keeping newsboys, you know. There are lots of reasons. Parents don't want the boys out, and big older boys will rob the boys of their money and things like that.
That was the end of a safe and wholesome era. By the end of the 1980s, after drugs became a Baltimore City stronghold, and the use of paperboys was, by and large, a thing of the past, some young black men were back out on the street working. In East Baltimore, paperboy-aged youngsters were finding employment as drug runners for Maurice Peanut King, a notorious heroin dealer whose eventual takedown the Afro covered extensively, beginning in 1982. These days, Mr. Massey is one of few remaining print paper deliverers for the Afro. He says he no longer delivers to private residences, but instead mainly to grocery stores and other businesses. I can attest to that. Our interview with him came after a bit of a wild goose chase that took us to the Druid Hill Y, where an old-school Afro vending coin box sits in the lobby, back to the Afro offices where one such box is stationed on the sidewalk outside, and right back to WEAA's offices. As it turns out, one of the stops on his route is right inside our building at Morgan State University's School of Global Journalism and Communication. We asked him how much longer he thought physical newspaper delivery would exist.
It ain't gonna be long. I mean, everybody's gone to the internet now, and a lot of our folks are dying off, you know, the elderly. That's who's supporting us, the elderly. I mean, they are, if we didn't have them, where would we be? Plus the history, you know. So we're just trying to instill values with the kids, letting them know that, hey, we've been around a while, 122 years we've been around, you know, and we're still here.
Despite the potential expiration date on physical paper delivery, Mr. Massey says the Afro's strong generational presence in Baltimore City's communities will sustain it.
People still remember me from way back when I was a kid, and now my daughter's working at the Afro, so it's passing on. So hopefully her kids will be there, you know.
My name is Sherica Massey Ortiz. I'm from the West Side, and I work as an assistant for the archives. My dad was talking about how you can learn history by, you know, reading the newspaper. So I just wanted to learn about the history.
The archives, both physical and digital, are one of the many ways the Afro plans to draw the interest of a younger audience. Families like the Masseys, with a multi-generational investment in the circulation of and access to the Afro, embody the success of that effort. Sherica is the mother of a 3-year-old and an almost 2-year-old. She's already brought them to the Afro building and says she'll continue to bring them as they get older. Up next, we'll talk to current editors and reporters for the Afro about their plans to take the paper into the next phase of its future. You've been listening to Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We've taken you into the archives of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, and you've heard from generations of the Murphy family, who still owns it. I told you at the top of the show that the Afro building is a time machine. It's true. You enter it and lose yourself in the past. In that past, nearly 100 reporters, editors, photographers, and other staff members bustled from floor to floor. But things are much different now. On the days that we visited the Afro, there were fewer than 20 staff members, none of whom were reporters. There's a good reason for that. These days, the majority of the Afro staff members are freelancers. They work remotely, leaving the once electric, collaborative buzz of the newsroom eerily quiet.
My name is Lisa Snowden McCray, and I'm a journalist and freelance writer for the Afro. I've been working for the Afro for about a year and a half. Because we're all freelance, other than that, it's hard to really see anybody. In the first few weeks that I was writing for them, Mr. Oliver decided he wanted to have a meeting with all the freelancers. So, like, even the people from D.C. came down, and we all met at the Baltimore office. And it was just all of us sitting around this table. And it's just all these black people who are writers and photographers, and that was kind of cool. It feels really good to work for the Afro and kind of be part of the legacy of all the people since like the 1800s.
Senior Afro contributor and weekly columnist Sean Yoes remembers the days when meetings like that were commonplace. He started at the Afro in 1989 when its offices were still somewhat lively.
When I first came to the Afro, we had 4 full-time reporters. We had a sports department. We had full-time photographers. It was more of an operation. And now we don't have any full-time reporters.
I asked Sean if in the 20-plus years he's worked for the Afro, he's ever considered leaving for a mainstream or predominantly white press, where resources might be less limited.
I've been asked, but I have never really seriously considered it. Not really.
I ask this because black publications like the Afro, which historically were the only places for black writers to seek employment, have increasingly become training grounds for newer black reporters in the decades following the civil rights movement, pit stops for many on their way to bigger, better-funded newsrooms. Reporters like Sean, whose loyalties lie with the black press career-long, are fewer and farther between.
It's tough. It is tough. It is the consensus that I've heard from most people working for the mainstream press, especially when they come from an advocacy journalist background like the Afro, is that it's not easy because it's just a totally different vibe. There's a lot of pressure put on you. The Afro is like family to me. You go work in a mainstream newspaper, it's probably not going to be the same. There are different pressures put on reporters working for a newspaper that it has more of a corporate bottom line.
Sean remembers working with one of the Afro's most iconic reporters, an experience that could not have been replicated at any other press.
I worked with Sam Lacy. He was the dean of black sports writers. He is a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He, along with Wendell Smith, are responsible for breaking Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball and breaking the color barrier. I wrote a story once. It was a now Lafayette Courts. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a low-income housing high-rise. And I remember I wrote this lead and that talked about the conditions at Lafayette Courts. And Mr. Lacey came to me and says, "Y'all's, that was very good lead you wrote." And I almost passed out, like, because this is, I mean, he was literally a living legend. And for him to be gracious enough to notice my work and then to compliment me, it was, that let me know, I was a very young cat, and I let me know that maybe I was doing something right.
Mentorship is still important to all aspiring journalists, and even today, the Afro remains committed to it.
I actually got involved with the Afro after an administrator here sent out a mass email saying that they were hiring for an internship.
Akira Kiles is a student at Morgan State University, majoring in multimedia journalism. The Afro's relationship with Morgan State dates back almost as far as the paper itself. Both the school and the press are incubators of Black talent.
The way that my advisor speaks to me is like I can pretty much do anything. That's the way he speaks to me, and honestly, most of the time, that's exactly how I feel from the way he speaks to me. Like, he has compared me. He said, "We're trying to get you to be just like this New York Times reporter or this Washington Post reporter," and those people can often be white, but he's saying, "I'm just trying to get you where they are. It doesn't matter what color they are. He's just trying to get me there. Give me all the steps so I can do exactly what they're doing."
Last June, veteran journalist Kamau High joined the Afro, working as a reporter before quickly being promoted to managing editor. He believes the future of the paper is strong, in part because of its continued commitment to in-depth reporting on issues relevant to the Black community.
I mean, if you compare the staff of the Baltimore Sun to the Afro, it's apples and oranges. They employ, conservatively, hundreds of people. You just can't compete with that. But that's like saying the Baltimore Sun doesn't compete with the Associated Press. They both do journalism, but the Associated Press does it on a way different scale than they do. But we like to think that in our community, our people, and things that are of our interest to our readers, that we are even better than the Sun. I like to think that we like to keep track on the many organizations that have sprung up in the wake of the events of last April after the death of Freddie Gray. And we, in addition to sort of talking about them and what those organizations are attempting to do, we try to keep an eye on them and to make sure that they are fulfilling the promises that they have made. And I don't think the Sun does nearly as good a job as we do.
We asked Kamau for a recent example of in-depth reporting that's distinct to the Afro. The story he told us harkened back to ones I'd read in long-archived editions of the paper, both searing and sensational, a story I wouldn't have found anywhere else.
I went out in the wake of the riots to do sort of a post-riot story of, you know, how are some of these businesses getting on? And it was, I believe, the day after. And I decided to go counterintuitively down to the Inner Harbor, which was not nearly as damaged, but suffered significant damage as well. And I was speaking with a owner of a pawn shop, whose the name of the pawn shop escapes me. And I said, well, and when I came across them, they were sort of doing repair work to the pawn shop. And I started talking to them. I said, you know, what happened? You know, what happened? And he told me how at the height of the riots, someone tried to break in, and him and several people were there, and he picked up a machete and then began hacking at the arm that was grasping, trying to make its way through the door. Blood spewed everywhere, and unsurprisingly, the arm retreated. And to prove this story to me, he then showed me the bloody machete. So I said, that's what's really real.
So much has changed over the course of the Afro's history. But even with the gains of Black communities throughout history, have the original objectives of the Black press changed? I think John Murphy III's answer to that question in 1971 is as accurate as any answer an Afro employee would give today.
The thrust has been basically the same. At one time you thought maybe you were at the end of the road in protesting, but really when you look at the broad thing, you were really no further ahead than you were, say, 50 years ago in degree.
John H. Murphy III said, "At one time, you thought maybe you were at the end of the road in protesting, but really, when you look at the broad thing, you're really no further ahead than you were, say, 50 years ago in degree. You're still fighting for the same things, maybe with different people and from a different level." This program is produced by Stacia Brown and brought to you by WEAA 88.9 FM as part of Finding America, a national initiative produced by AIR with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Baltimore, the Rise of Charm City's field production team includes Ali Post, Mavish Raza, and Marsha Jews. Theme music by Mark Gunnery for the Center for Emerging Media. For photos and video from the Afro and the people you just heard talking about it, visit riseofcharmcity.com or follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We're at Rise of Charm City.
Welcome back to Marsha Jews and Company. We keep it moving on WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and more. Well, we have John J. Oliver, we fondly known as Jake. He's the chairman of the board, publisher of the historic Afro-American newspaper. The Afro-American newspaper, family-owned business, is currently celebrating over 120 years of providing news and information to Black and other minority communities, and initially focused on providing a voice for Blacks who were often ignored and marginalized by other news outlets. I'm not going to go two more in depth on what I need to read to you, but rather I'd rather have the man himself on the air talking about this 125th anniversary of the Afro, which will be celebrated on August the 12th. Hey, Jake.
How you doing, Marsha? Pleasure to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you on the air with us. How'd you like that Baltimore, the Rise of Charm City?
Oh, I thought it was quite good. I thought it was very, very thorough. It gave you a sort of like an audible, panoramic view of what the Afro has experienced and what the Afro has been providing the Black community over its 122 years.
And you know what I think is really interesting is that, you know, I think that people don't really realize, and I don't think I did growing up in a South Bend, Indiana, that it's important, it's imperative for me now. I can't imagine not getting news about Black people. And the larger press, it's far and few between in the majority of that information. And it's not to just, you know, be mean, but it's just being real that I can't find all the wonderful stories of all the wonderful people who are doing exceptional things and or all the horrible things that are happening to our people in different parts of the country. And it's really important, and especially here in the Baltimore, Washington area. What do you see as, we heard there and we know that the world is changing. We have papers going out of business all the time. But I think that one of the things, because you've been so innovative, and I have to say this, ladies and gentlemen, but my disclosure, Jake, is that I've worked for the Afro. So I'm one of those folks that back in the 80s when I first got here. What do you see as the future for the Afro?
I see the Afro continuing to be a source of Black-focused news. But more, it's going to be regional as it is now, but it's quickly becoming national because of the way the news is being dispersed. The distribution of news over the Internet was a major step. But quite frankly, the thing that has changed the entire medium has been social, has been the social media. People are now getting their news a lot faster, and they have developed an expectation. Indeed, they're demanding that they get the news almost instantaneous. And the result of the technologies that have emerged in the last 5 years, more and more newspapers are being able to provide the news and compete with TV and other outlets in a way that we never really imagined to be able to do in the past. But it also represents a substantial risk.
What? Because, why do you say that?
The technologies that are emerging not only makes it easier for people to get their news faster, but it makes a lot more it's a lot more easier for anybody to put out what they think is news but is not necessarily fake news, which highlights the importance of newspapers, because regardless of what way you receive the news, you really need to get the benefit of the journalistic discipline.
Yes.
And that doesn't exist in a lot of places in the internet world, and which is the reason why you need to really focus on, well, who are these people and what are their experience and how do I know what they're telling me is true? How have they confirmed the facts that I can rely on, and therefore should I? So that's a risk. That's a gigantic risk. But also, it's not, Marcia, it's not the way it used to be when, you know, reporters would show up like Sean Yoes and the rest of the guys with their notepads and start asking questions. Now reporters show up with their smartphones and just put it up and start videotaping an interview. So pretty much we become a TV. I mean, we can compete with TV in ways that I think the TV has never imagined. That's a source of fun, but it's also it is challenging in many respects. Otherwise, you know, we're dealing with can you get the visibility with a smartphone that you nevertheless get in the evening at 6 o'clock? The answer is no. Which will change as the phones get smarter and their ability to pick up lighting becomes a lot better than our ability to really give you high definition videos on phones that really are equivalent to what you get on TV. It's going to become a reality, and that's coming real soon.
Yeah, it's coming down the pike. I mean, I think that we don't even realize that they have new telephones already set up, you know, next generation for the next 10 years already made and sitting in the warehouse waiting for yours to burn up or whatever it does. How, you know, like I said, okay, they must be ready to launch the new thing. So here's a question for you with the... What is so beautiful about this company is this is a family-owned business, and it has been a family-owned business for 125 years. How does the Murphy family continue that legacy? What are you all doing from an infrastructure standpoint to carry this legacy on?
Well, I have a lot of kids. That helps. The most important thing to me is that there's a level of respect for the obligation that they have benefited from as being part of the Murphy family. They really understand the importance of the service that the newspaper has always meant to provide. And believe me, they are, they scrutinize what we do a lot for purposes of ensuring, from their individual perspective, that they're living up to the heritage and the legacy that John H. started back, in 1892. Granted, it's a different world.
Yes.
And when you look at the early editions, it's a different black community. I mean, back then in 1892, folks had only been out of enslavement for about 40-some years. Mm-hmm. And a large swath of the black population simply couldn't read. So first question, I imagine that my great-grandfather was facing was, why are you attempting to create a newspaper for a community that can't read?
Right.
But I think he had faith in God. He also had faith in the evolution that the black community would and will rapidly evolve to recognizing the ability to learn how to read enough to begin to respect what a newspaper of the Afro's type of vintage represents and was giving them. And over the first couple decades in the 20th century, you could see how, as a result of that, our voice began to grow up. Hmm. At first, you know, between 1900 and 1910, I don't think you saw many black folks objecting to very many things because they were still pretty much hesitant about what white folks were going to do to them.
Right.
They were put us in chains once, they can put them back on.
That's right. That's right.
But after at the end of the first decade of the 20th century, the NAACP and other things started to emerge that really reflected the sense that, hey, look, we're Americans just as much as anybody else, and we are entitled to a lot of the things that these folks have illegally attempted to restrict us from. And you could see, beginning in the second decade, how that voice became a lot more vocal, a lot more prominent, so much so that, you know, at the beginning of the third decade, you really started to see black folks began to push back. And it's interesting because they did it in so many different ways. A lot of the ways were very subtle. But it's like watching, you know, maybe like a wrestling match. You know, you got the bad guys and the good guys, and the bad guys always beating up on the good guys until the good guys eventually finds a weakness or a stronghold, and boom, he slam dunks the guy. You know, and that's what, you know, we saw, particularly as it approached the fifth decade of the 20th century, where the so-called modern day civil rights movement, but the fact of the matter is, the civil rights movement existed from day one.
Right.
That we became emancipated. And it's been a constant battle. It's just.
And it's still here today. Yeah, and it's still here today.
Right. Oh, it's as the more things change, the more they remain.
Mm-hmm. So, Jake, when we look at the Afro and. You do have subscriber emails, and so we can get the Afro online. We can go to the Facebook. We can go to all these places. And I think what is really important is that how do we manage to stay relevant in an environment that is changing so? And we sort of touched on it, but when we've got so many, you have over 1 million people who are on Facebook. On the Afro's Facebook page. How do you keep those people engaged? And they're from where?
It's a hard job. Because right now, I mean, the Afro literally is a daily newspaper. We're posting constantly on our website, and we are constantly having what we post on the website go out over Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
The reach of our paper depends upon what the news is. Some weeks it does go over a million and a half. It's been up to maybe 4 or 5 million in some weeks, depending upon what the news is.
Okay, the articles. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the content really drives it. But the point that really makes it work for us is that we are constantly, we're constantly posting all the time. It's a rare occasion that we do not post something, at least one or two stories every hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we're constantly looking out there to see what is news. And we tap into the various sources. And then we have lots of people who contribute to us. You know, you do have bloggers.
Right.
And they're important because they provide an opinion on issues that reflect the feeling of large segments of the black community. But you know something that's also interesting about this new social media world that we find ourselves in? We, like we just discussed in the 20th century where we were developing a voice,
right?
That voice has now become a lot easier for the individual to air their personal thoughts. And we're beginning to see how varied the black communities line of thinking is on so many different issues. Everyone thinks, well, you're black, so you're going to think one way. That's not true. We are very segmented. We're made up of individuals who happen to be black, who have developed their own thought on many issues individually. However, they are all unified in connection with anything that they feel is basically threatening them simply because of their race.
Hmm.
That's what brings us together. But on just about every other issue, we are segmented. It's interesting. It's entertaining. It's surprising in many respects.
So when we look at we're going forward, we have a new president in office. Mm. And I don't know that, you know, everybody, I think you said there was something earlier where we talked about faux news. You said, how do we keep people focused on what the real news is and their takeaway with, as you said, there was something about being preachy is what Stacia said. But it's really, the Afro was also instructive. Here's what you should be thinking about. Here's what you should be considering. How do we function in this environment with this type of leadership in Washington?
We have got to... You know, this is not the first time, Marcia, that we've been confronted with this.
Okay.
And the first time was when Woodrow Wilson was elected,
mm-hmm.
as reflected in the piece that you just had,
yes.
in the early part of the show. And what happened was the moment we realized that not only we had been tricked, but when he was reelected, the entire community was pretty much like it was the day that we woke up and realized that the current president had been elected.
Mm-hmm.
It says, well, maybe this is a bad dream and maybe I'm too close. And then we realized that, no, we are now in a different reality that we had never imagined. And what we did... In 1916 and 1913, was that we developed an ability to get pull close. We pulled in the ranks. We started to clear the communication channels that existed and create new ones that made us even more informed about what was going
mm-hmm.
on. We became our own best cheerleaders, but we also began to develop our own strategies that began to permit us to become stronger as a community, as a group of people. We started to challenge in many different ways perceptions which were historically used to keep the black man down.
Hmm.
And we basically were able to, sort of establish our personality and redefine ourselves. As we became stronger. And that's what we're going to be, that's what we're doing now. That's how you survive an environment that we're currently in. Folks are now the churches are going to become important now as far as sources of communication, sources of building spiritual strength that has always been a backbone of this community. And to become more strategic in addressing those things. But we're also going to let those who stand in our way understand you are out of bounds, and we're going to let you know every time you make a misstep. And that's, again, where the Afro and the black press is so important, because the moment we can communicate an injustice, and right now it's unfortunate that we're reporting, but that's what we have to do too many times.
Right.
When cops are the violence of the police force, we have suffered too long.
Mm-hmm.
And every time there is some injustice, not only with respect to the killing of another black person, but also the next time that there is another cop who has killed a black person who walks out of the court free, we're going to let the entire population know exactly that has happened. And Marcia, it happens at least once or twice a week.
I know.
Across this country.
And it's pathetic. I am one who believes that we can't, we as a people And for those of you who are within the sound of my voice, between the National Newspaper Association and obviously the Afro-American newspaper here in Baltimore, Washington, and all the rest of the papers that are involved, we have to really be very clear of how important our papers are for us. I can't imagine not having a black paper, black magazine. I want to see people who look like me. That doesn't mean that I don't want to see other people. That doesn't mean that I don't want to read other news. But I want to see about what's happening in my community with my businesses and people who look like me. And I think that we have to really say that out loud. I'm unapologetically black, and I write black with a capital B. And I think that what we have gotten away from, and please correct me because you've seen this legacy for 125 years in your papers. Do you see a change or a shift in how black people are relating to being the blackness? Or do you think that integration has done anything to how we see not only ourselves, but our products?
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. Primarily because of the fact that this generations who are thirsty to learn, but they don't have, they haven't felt the sting of the historical experiences that are have been reflected in black press and specifically the Afro for 125 years.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't witnessed the picking up a paper and seeing that, well, this past year you had 71 lynchings in this country, and 67 of them were black men.
Wow.
And one black woman, and then realize that where's justice?
Right.
I mean and the only way we have to remind people of how far we've come, but also in the process get them to realize how much further we have to go, and then we can get them to rationalize, to say that, you know, this looks exactly like something I read in the historical edition of the Afro, or an anniversary edition of the Afro, that happened in 1919.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just, you know, 1919, you can understand that, but, you know, maybe we haven't changed.
Maybe we haven't. And I think that's where the fear is. Now, one of the things that I think that is so important and why I really wanted you all here was that on August the 12th of this year, 2017, the Afro is celebrating its 125th birthday. And you're having a birthday bash gala. Can you tell us anything about that?
A little bit. We're very excited about it.
Yes,
and we are in the throes of planning, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a committee that has been working very hard to make this a meaningful gathering, not only for historical reasons, but also it is a celebration. It's a party.
Yes.
And we want people to have a great time just sort of reveling in the historical significance of 125 years.
Isn't that amazing? That's a long time. But you're also celebrating the and having your Margot, the author of Hidden Figures.
Right.
And she's being celebrated, Margot Lee. She's mm-hmm. going to be she's a honoree and guest speaker. And then you've got Joyce Scott, who is received the Genius Award, and Jeff Ballou, who is the first black president of the National Press Club. So they should be there. That should be very interesting. And Joyce is always so crazy. She's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but she's a very accomplished guy.
No question.
Very gifted.
No question. I think it was a $600,000 Genius Award.
Yeah.
But also, you will have auctions that are going on. There's going to be dancing, a lot of camaraderie. We'll have all kinds of activities with pictures and all kinds of stuff like that. How do we get in touch with getting tickets? And There's still room for vendors. There's still a couple of tables left. You all need to be here. This is a huge, huge event. And it's a huge event because 125 years with the same black family managing this corporation was not an easy feat, I'm sure. No. And we need to make certain that we come out in droves to support this organization and this family. So I think we go to afro125.com.
That's correct.
Afro125.com, and you can buy tickets. You can learn about the special. Oh, they're going to do a, you're doing a special 125 edition for the paper, right? With the culmination of all the highlights from 125 years.
Pretty much like we did 5 years ago.
I love it.
We're going to give people, it's going to be a collector's item, but we want something to at least remind people, but also teach people. This is what it was like, and this is how we got to today.
All right.
So that they can remember, and they, in turn, can do some teaching.
Thank you. Jake Oliver, chairman and publisher of the Afro-American newspaper, celebrating 125 years. Thank you, Jake.
Thanks for inviting me. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you recognizing the Afro, and we at the Afro thank you and appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you. You're listening to Marcia Jews and Company. We keep it moving on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Huge thanks to you, our listeners, our amazing team, Stacia and Allie. Thanks for allowing us to use the Rise of Charm City. Engineer Andre, production director Mike, associate producer Iori, entertainment producer Meredith, segment producer Sandy, content editor Peyton. To learn more about our upcoming shows and guests or to share your thoughts or subscribe to our newsletter, keep it moving, Marcia Jews at gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks again for listening. Please tune in next week to WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Until then, remember to keep it moving.